Hello, hello. Welcome back to another section of A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. Make sure you see the whole name there. Hope you're enjoying this one. Hope you're staying healthy and safe if you're watching this like in real time. You know, stay safe out there. Hope you enjoy the holidays with your family this time around. And oh god, my thing is slipping. I'm living dangerously. I don't have a case on my phone right now, so I'm just kind of like trying to figure it out. Oh boy. We'll see how this goes. Anyway, this might be a somewhat shorter section. I'm keeping this in. This is funny. This might be a shorter section because I don't feel like I have tons of time to record right now. There goes slipping again. All right, we're on page 267. We're in the middle of a chapter. I think the chapter is called like Ascending, Alighting, something like that. This worked yesterday. Good god, get a grip, girl. Oh no, it's just happening again. Okay, we might have some stability. We'll adjust as need be. I'm gonna catch it, it's gonna fall all the way. Let's try this again. Page 267. It had been a long day for the Count, one of the longest in memory. On the verge of exhaustion, he brushed his teeth and donned his pajamas almost as quickly as Sophia had. Then, returning to the bedroom, he put out the light and eased himself onto the mattress under Sophia's bedsprings. True, the Count had no bedsprings of his own, and the stacked tomato cans barely suspended Sophia's bed high enough for him to turn on his side. But it was a decided improvement upon the hardwood floor. So, having lived a day that his father would have been proud of, and hearing Sophia's delicate respirations, the Count closed his eyes and prepared to drift into a dreamless sleep. But, alas, sleep did not come so easily to our weary friend. Like in a reel in which the dancers form two rows so that one of their number can come skipping brightly down the aisle, a concern of the Count's would present itself for consideration. Bow with a flourish, and then take its place at the end of the line so that the next concern could come dancing to the fore. What exactly were the Count's concerns? He was worried about Mishka, although he had been genuinely relieved to discover that his friend's distress stemmed from the elision of four sentences on the 300th page of the third volume. He couldn't help but feel with a certain sense of foreboding that the matter of the 50 words was not entirely behind them. He was worried about Nina and her journey east. The Count had not heard much about Sevastopol, but he had heard enough about Siberia to comprehend the inhospitability of the road that Nina had chosen for herself. He was worried about little Sophia, and not simply over the cutting of her meat and the changing of her clothes. Whether dining in the piazza or riding the elevator to the fifth floor, a little girl in the metropole would not go unnoticed for long. Though Sophia was only staying with the Count for a matter of weeks, there was always the possibility that before Nina's return, some bureaucrat would become aware of her residency and forbid it. And finally, in the interests of being utterly forthright, it should be added that the Count was worried about the following morning, when, having nibbled her biscuit and stolen his strawberries, Sophia would once again climb into his chair and look back at him with her dark blue eyes. Perhaps it is inescapable that when our lives are in flux, despite the comfort of our beds, we are bound to keep ourselves awake, grappling with anxieties, no matter how great or small, how real or imagined. But in point of fact, Count Rostov had good reason to be concerned about his old friend Mishka. When he left the metropole late on the night of the 21st of June, Mikhail Mindich followed the Count's advice to the letter. He went straight to the hotel, bathed, ate, and tucked himself in for a good night's sleep. And when he awoke, he looked upon the events of the previous day with more perspective. In the light of morning, he saw that the Count was perfectly right, that it was only a matter of 50 words, and that it was not as if Shalimov had asked him to cut the last lines of the cherry orchard or the seagull. It was a passage that might have appeared in the correspondence of any traveler in Europe, and that Chekhov himself had, in all probability, composed without a second thought. But after dressing and eating a late breakfast when Mishka headed to the Central House of Writers, he happened to pass the statue of Gorky on Arbatskaya Square, where the brooding statue of Gogol once stood. Other than Mayakovsky, Maxim Gorky had been Mishka's greatest contemporary hero. "Here was a man," said Mishka to himself as he stood in the middle of the sidewalk, ignoring the passersby, "who once wrote with such fresh and unsentimental directness that his memories of youth became our memories of youth. But having settled in Italy, he was lured back to Russia by Stalin in 34 and set up in Ryabushinsky's mansion so that he could preside over the establishment of socialist realism as the sole artistic style of the entire Russian people. And what has been the fallout of that?" Mishka demanded of the statue. All but ruined, Bulukov hadn't written a word in years. Akhmatova had put down her pen. Mendelstam, having already served his sentence, had apparently been arrested again. And Mayakovsky? Oh, Mayakovsky. Mishka pulled at the hairs of his beard. Back in 22, how boldly he had predicted to Sasha that these four would come together to forge a new poetry for Russia. Improbably, perhaps, but in the end, that is exactly what they had done. They had created the poetry of silence. "Yes, silence can be an option," said Mishka. "Silence can be a form of protest, it can be a means of survival, but it can also be a school of poetry, one with its own meter, tropes, and conventions. One that needn't be written with pencils or pens, but that can be written in the soul with a revolver to the chest." With that, Mishka turned his back on Maxim Gorky and the Central House of Writers and went back instead to the offices of Golizitsat, where he mounted the stairs, brushed past the receptionist, and opened door after door until he found the ferret in a conference room presiding over an editorial meeting. In the center of the table were platters of cheese and figs and cured herring, the very sight of which, for some unaccountable reason, filled Mishka with fury. Turning from Shalimov in order to see who had barged through the door were the junior editors and assistant editors, all young and earnest, a fact that only infuriated Mishka more. "Very good," he shouted. "I see you have your knives out. What will you be cutting in half today? The brothers Karamazov?" "Mikhail Fedorovich," said Shalimov in shock. "What is this?" Mishka proclaimed, pointing to a young woman who happened to have a slice of bread topped with herring in her hand. "Is that bread from Berlin? Be careful, comrade. If you take a single bite, Shalimov will shoot you from a cannon." Mishka could see that the young girl thought that he was mad, but she put the piece of bread back on the table nonetheless. "Aha!" Mishka exclaimed in vindication. Shalimov rose from his chair, both unnerved and concerned. "Mikhail," he said, "you are clearly upset. I would be happy to speak with you later in my office about whatever is on your mind, but as you can see, we're in the midst of a meeting, and we have hours of business to attend to." "Hours of business, of that I have no doubt." Mishka began ticking off the rest of the day's business, and with each item he picked up a manuscript from in front of one of the staff members and flung it across the room in Shalimov's direction. "There are statues to be moved, lines to be alighted, and at 5 o'clock you mustn't be late for your bath with Comrade Stalin, for if you are, who will be there to scrub his back?" "He's raving," said a young man with glasses. "Mikhail," Shalimov pleaded. "The future of Russian poetry is the haiku," Mishka shouted in conclusion. Then, with great satisfaction, he slammed the door on his way out. In fact, so satisfying was this gesture that he slammed every door that stood between him and the street below. And what, to borrow a phrase, was the fallout of that? Within a day, the gist of Mishka's comments were shared with the authorities. Within a week, they were set down word for word. In August, he was invited to the offices of the NKVD in Leningrad for questioning. In November, he was brought before one of the extrajudicial troikas of the era. And in March 1939, he was on a train bound for Siberia and the realm of second thoughts. The Count was presumably right to be concerned for Nina, though we will never know for certain, for she did not return to the metropole within the year, or ever again. In October, the Count made some efforts to discover her whereabouts, all of them fruitless. One assumes that Nina made her own efforts to communicate with the Count, but no word was forthcoming, and Nina Kolokova simply disappeared into the vastness of the Russian East. The Count was also right to worry that Sophia's residency would be noted, for not only was her presence remarked within a fortnight of her arrival, a letter was sent to an administrative office within the Kremlin stating that a former person living under house arrest on the top floor of the Metropole Hotel was caring for a 5-year-old child of unknown parentage. Upon its receipt, the letter was carefully read, stamped, and forwarded to a higher office, where it was counter-stamped and directed up another 2 floors. There it reached the sort of desk where, with the swipe of a pen, matrons from the state orphanage could be dispersed. It just so happened, however, that a cursory examination of this former person's recent associates led to a certain willowy actress, who for years had been the reputed paramour of a round-faced commissar recently appointed to the Politburo. Within the walls of a small drab office in an especially bureaucratic branch of government, it is generally difficult to accurately imagine the world outside, but it is never hard to imagine what might occur to one's career were one to seize the illegitimate daughter of a Politburo member and place her in a home. Such initiative would be rewarded with a blindfold and a cigarette. As a result, only the most discreet inquiries were made. Indications were obtained that this actress had, in all likelihood, been in a relationship with a Politburo member for at least 6 years. In addition, an employee of the hotel confirmed on the very day the young girl arrived at the hotel, the actress was also in residence. As such, all of the information that had been gathered in the course of the investigation was placed in a drawer under lock and key, on the off chance it might prove useful one day. While the pernicious little letter that had launched the inquiry in the first place was set on fire and dropped in the waste bin where it belonged. So yes, the Count had every reason to be concerned about Mishka, Nina, and Sophia. But did he have cause to be anxious about the following morning? As it turned out, once they had made their beds and nibbled their biscuits, Sophia did climb up into the desk chair, but rather than stare at the Count expectantly, she unfurled a litany of additional questions about Eidelhauer and his family, as if she had been composing them in her sleep. In the days that followed, a man who had long prided himself on his ability to tell a story in the most succinct manner, with an emphasis on the most salient points, by necessity, became master of the digression, the parenthetical remark, the footnote, eventually even learning to anticipate Sophia's relentless inquiries before she had the time to phrase them. Popular wisdom tells us that when the real of our concerns interferes with our ability to fall asleep, the best remedy is the counting of sheep in a meadow, but preferring to have his lamb encrusted with herbs and served with a red wine reduction, the Count chose a different methodology altogether. As he listened to Sophia breathing, he went back to the moment that he awoke on the hardwood floor, and by systematically reconstructing his various visits to the lobby, the piazza, the Boyarsky, Anna's suite, the basement, and Marina's office, he carefully calculated how many flights of stairs he had climbed or descended over the course of the day. Up and down he went in his mind, counting one flight after another, until, with the final ascent to the twice-tolling clock, he reached a grand total of 59, at which point he slipped into a well-deserved sleep. Addendum. Uncle Alexander? Sophia? Are you awake, Uncle Alexander?
I am now, my dear. What is it?
I left Dolly in Aunt Marina's room.
Ah, yes.
1946. On Saturday, the 21st of June, 1946, as the sun rose high over the Kremlin, a lone figure climbed slowly up the steps from the Moskva River embankment, continued past St. Basil's Cathedral, and made his way onto Red Square. Dressed in a ragged winter coat, he swung his right leg in a small semicircle as he walked. At another time, the combination of the ragged coat and hobbled leg might have made the man stand out on such a bright summer day. But in 1946, there were men limping about in borrowed clothes in every quarter of the capital. For that matter, they were limping about in every city of Europe. That afternoon, the square was as crowded as if it were a market day. Women in floral dresses lingered under the arcades of the old state department store before the gates of the Kremlin. Schoolboys climbed on two decommissioned tanks as soldiers in white fitted jackets standing at regular intervals watched with their hands clasped loosely behind their backs. And from the entrance of Lenin's tomb snaked a line 150 citizens long. The man in the ragged coat paused for a moment to admire the orderly behavior of his far-flung countrymen waiting in the queue. At the front stood eight Uzbeks with drooping mustaches dressed in their best silk coats. Then came four girls from the east with long braids and brightly embroidered caps. Then 10 Muzhiks from Georgia and so on, one constituency waiting patiently behind the next to pay their respects to the remains of a man who died over 20 years before. If we have learned nothing else, the lone figure reflected with a crooked smile, at least we have learned to stand in line. To a foreigner, it might have seemed that Russia had become the land of 10,000 lines, for there were lines at the tram stops, lines before the grocer, lines at the agencies of labor, education, and housing, but in point of fact, there were not 10,000 lines, or even 10. There was one all-encompassing line, which wound across the country and back through time. This had been Lenin's greatest innovation, a line that, like the proletariat itself, was universal and infinite. He established it by decree in 1917 and personally took the first slot as his comrades jostled to line up behind him. One by one, every Russian took his place, and the line grew longer and longer until it shared all of the attributes of life. In it, friendships were formed and romances kindled, patience was fostered, civility practiced, even wisdom attained. If one is to stand in line for 8 hours to purchase a loaf of bread, the lone figure thought, what is an hour or two to see the corpse of a hero free of charge? Passing the spot where Kazan Cathedral had once seen fit to stand, he turned right and walked on. But as he entered Theater Square, he came to a stop, for as his gaze moved from the Palace of Unions to the Bolshoi, to the Mali Theater, and finally to the Metropole Hotel, he had to marvel to find so many of the old facades unspoiled. 5 years before, to the day, the Germans had launched Operation Barbarossa, the offensive in which more than 3 million soldiers deployed from Odessa to the Baltic crossed the Russian frontier. When the operation commenced, Hitler estimated the Wehrmacht would secure Moscow within 4 months. In fact, having captured Minsk, Kiev, and Smolensk by late October, the German forces had already advanced nearly 600 miles and were approaching Moscow from the north and south in a classic pincer formation. Within a matter of days, the city would be in range of their artillery. By this time, the measure of lawlessness had broken out in the capital. The streets were crowded with refugees and deserters who were sleeping in makeshift encampments and cooking looted food over open fires. With the relocation of the seat of government to Kubyshev underway, the 16 bridges of the city were mined so that they could be demolished on a moment's notice. Columns of smoke rose above the Kremlin walls from the bonfires of classified files, while in the streets, municipal and factory workers who had not been paid in months watched with seasoned foreboding as the eternally lit windows of the old fortress began to go dark one by one. But on the afternoon of the 30th of October, an observer standing in the very spot where our ragged itinerant now stood, would have witnessed a bewildering sight. A small cadre of laborers under the direction of the secret police were carrying chairs out of the Bolshoi on their way to the Mayakovsky metro station. Later that night, the full membership of the Politburo assembled on the platform 150 feet below the surface of the city. Safe from the reach of German artillery, they took their seats at 9 o'clock at a long table lined with food and wine. Shortly thereafter, a single train pulled into the station, its doors opened, and out stepped Stalin in full military dress. Assuming his rightful position at the head of the table, Marshal Soso said that his purpose in convening the party leadership was twofold. first it was to declare that while those assembled were welcome to make their way to Koibyshev, he, for one, had no intention of going anywhere. He would remain in Moscow until the last drop of Russian blood had been spilled. Second, he announced that on the 7th of November, the annual commemoration of the revolution would be celebrated on Red Square, as usual. Many Muscovites would come to remember that parade as something of a turning point, to hear the heart-swelling sound of the Internationale to the accompaniment of 50,000 boots while their leader stood defiant on the rostrum, bolstered their confidence and hardened their resolve. On that day, they would recall the tide decidedly turned. Others, however, would point to the 700,000 soldiers whom Soso had held in reserve in the Far East, and who, even as the celebration was taking place, were being spirited across the country to Moscow's aid. Still others would note that it snowed on 28 of the 31 days that December, effectively grounding the Luftwaffe. It certainly didn't hurt that the average temperature fell to minus 20, a climate as alien to the Wehrmacht as it had been to the forces of Napoleon. Whatever the cause, although it took Hitler's troops just 5 months to march from the Russian frontier to the outskirts of Moscow, they would never pass through the city's gates. Having taken over 1 million prisoners and 1 million lives, they would begin their retreat in January 1942, leaving the city surprisingly intact. Stepping from the curb, our lone figure gave way to a young officer driving a motorcycle with a girl in a bright orange dress in his sidecar. He passed between the two captured German fighter planes on display in the defoliated square, then skirting the Metropole's main entrance, he wound around the corner and disappeared down the alley at the back of the hotel. Part 2. Don't think I'm going to get all the way through this chapter, but let's start. Page 278. Antics, antitheses, and accident. At 1:30 in the manager's office of the Metropole Hotel, Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov took the chair across the desk from the man with the narrow head and superior demeanor. When the count had received the bishop's summons in the piazza, he had assumed the matter must be urgent because the messenger had waited for him to finish his demitasse and then led him promptly to the executive suite. But once the count had been ushered through the manager's door, the bishop barely glanced up from the papers he was signing. Rather, he waved his pen toward the empty chair in the manner of one who wishes to indicate that he will be with you in a moment. "Thank you," said the count, accepting this perfunctory offer of a chair with a perfunctory bow of the head. Not one to sit idly about, the count made use of the empty minutes by surveying the office, which had undergone something of a transformation since Joseph Halecki had occupied it. While the desk of the former manager remained, it was no longer impressively bare. Along with 6 piles of paper, it now boasted a stapler, a pen holder, and 2 telephones, presumably so the bishop could put the central committee on hold while he dialed up the Politburo. In place of the burgundy chaise, where the old Pole had allegedly reclined, there were now 3 gray filing cabinets with stainless steel locks standing at attention. And the delightful hunting scenes that had once adorned the mahogany panels had been replaced, of course, with portraits of Messrs. Stalin, Lenin, and Marx. Having inscribed his signature on 12 sheets of paper to his perfect satisfaction, the bishop established a 7th pile at the edge of his desk, replaced the pen in its stand, and for the first time looked the count in the eye. "I gather you are an early riser, Alexander Ilyich," he said after a moment of silence. "Men of purpose usually are." The corner of the bishop's mouth rose ever so slightly. "Yes, of course, men of purpose." He reached across his desk to straighten his newest pile of papers. "And your breakfast in your room at about 7? "That's right. Then at 8 it is your habit to read the papers in the lobby." "Confound the fellow," thought the count. "He interrupts the conclusion of a perfectly delightful lunch with a hand-delivered summons. Clearly there is something on his mind, but must it always be on the bias with him? Has he no facility with the direct question? No appreciation for it? Were they to sit there reviewing the count's typical day minute by minute when the triumvirate was scheduled to meet in less than an hour?" "Yes," confirmed the count, a little impatiently. I read the morning papers in the morning. But in the lobby. You come down to the lobby. Without fail, I walk down the stairs to read in the comfort of the lobby. The bishop sat back in his chair and offered the briefest of smiles. Think perhaps you are aware of the incident that occurred this morning on the fourth floor corridor at 7:45. For the record, the count had risen shortly after 7, having completed 15 squats and 15 stretches, having enjoyed his coffee, biscuit, and a piece of fruit, today a tangerine, having bathed, shaved, and dressed, he kissed Sophia on the forehead and departed from their bedroom with the intention of reading papers in his favorite lobby chair. Descending one flight, he exited the belfry and transversed the hall to the main stair, as was his habit. But as he turned on the fifth floor landing, he heard sounds of commotion coming from below. The immediate impression was of 15 voices shouting in 20 languages. These were accompanied by the slamming of a door, the shattering of a plate, and a rather insistent squawking that seemed distinctly avian in character. When he reached the fourth floor at approximately 7:45, the count, in fact, discovered a genuine state of upheaval. Nearly every door was opened, and every guest in the hall. Among those assembled were two French journalists, a Swiss diplomat, three Uzbek fur traders, a representative of the Roman Catholic Church, and a repatriated opera tenor with his family of 5. Still in their pajamas, most of the members of this convention were waving their arms and expressing themselves emphatically, as 3 adult geese scurried between their legs, honking and beating their wings. Several of the women were acting as terrorized as if they had been descended upon by harpies. The wife of the tenor was cowering behind her husband's prodigious torso, and Christina, one of the hotel's chambermaids, was backed against a wall, clutching an empty tray to her chest, while at her feet lay a confusion of cutlery and kasha. When the tenor's 3 sons displayed their fortitude by giving chase to the 3 different birds in 3 different directions, the ambassador from the Vatican advised the tenor on the proper behavior of children. The tenor, who spoke only a few words of Italian, informs the prelate, Fortissimo, that he was not a man to be toyed with. The Swiss diplomat, who spoke both Russian and Italian fluently, exemplified his nation's reputation for neutrality by listening to both men with his mouth shut. When the prelate stepped forward to make his point more pontifically, one of the geese, which had been cornered by the tenor's eldest son, shot through his legs into his apartment, at which point a young woman, who was decidedly not a representative of the Roman Catholic Church, came racing into the hall, wrapped only in a blue kimono. By this point, the commotion had apparently awakened the guests on the fifth floor, as several came tromping down the stairs to see what all the fuss was about. At the forefront of this contingent was the American general, a no-nonsense figure who hailed from what is reportedly known as the Great State of Texas. Having quickly assessed the situation, the general grabbed one of the geese by the throat. The speed with which he captured the bird gave those assembled a boost of confidence. Several even cheered him on. That is, until he wrapped his second hand around the goose's neck with the clear intention of snapping it. This elicited a scream from the young woman in the blue kimono, tears from the tenor's daughter, and a stern reproach from the Swiss diplomat. Stymied at the very instant of decisive action, the general expressed his exasperation with the feckleness of civilians, walked into the prelate's apartment, and tossed the goose out the window. Committed to restoring order, the general returned a moment later and deftly seized a second goose. But when he held up this bird to assure the assembly of his peaceful intent, the tie at his waist unraveled and his robe flew open, revealing a seasoned pair of olive-green briefs, prompting the wife of the tenor to faint. As the count watched these proceedings from the landing, he became aware of a presence at his side. Turning, he found it was the general's aide-de-camp, a gregarious fellow who had become something of a fixture in the Shilopin. Taking in the scene at a glance, the aide-de-camp issued a sigh of satisfaction and then remarked to no one in particular, "How I love this hotel." So was the count aware of what took place in the fourth floor corridor at 7:45? One might just as well ask if Noah was aware of the flood or Adam the apple. Of course he was aware. No man on earth was more aware, but what aspect of his awareness could possibly warrant the interruption of a demitasse? "I am familiar with this morning's events," confirmed the count, "as I happened to be rounding the landing at the very moment they occurred." "So you witnessed the mayhem in person?" Yes, I saw the antics unfolding firsthand. Even so, I'm not entirely certain as to why I am here. Nor in the dark, as it were. In point of fact, I am flummoxed. Mystified. Of course. Following a moment of silence, the bishop offered his most ecclesiastical smile. Then, as if it were perfectly normal to wander about an office in the middle of a conversation, he rose and crossed to the wall, where he gingerly straightened the portrait of Mr. Marks, who, having slipped on his hook, was admittedly undermining the ideological authority of the room. Turning back, the bishop continued, "I can see why, in describing these unfortunate events, you chose to discard mayhem in favor of antics. For antics do seem to suggest a certain childishness." The count considered this for a moment. "You don't suspect the tenor's boys?" "Hardly. After all, the geese have been locked in a cage in the pantry of the Boyarsky. Are you suggesting that Emil had something to do with it?" The bishop ignored the count's question and resumed his place behind the desk. Oh no, I think I mixed up who's saying what. "You don't suspect the tenor's boys?" "Hardly. After all, the geese had been locked in a cage in the pantry of the Boyarsky. Are you suggesting that Emil had something to do with it?" The bishop ignored the count's question and resumed his place behind the desk. "The Metropole Hotel," he informed the count unnecessarily, "is host to some of the world's most eminent statesmen and prominent artistes. When they pass through our doors, they have the right to expect unparalleled comfort, unsurpassed service, and mornings free of mayhem. Needless to say," he concluded, reaching for his pen, "I shall get to the bottom of this." "Well," replied the count, rising from his chair, "if getting to the bottom is what is called for, I am sure there is no man better suited for the job." "A certain childishness," muttered the count as he exited the executive suite. "Mornings of mayhem." Did the bishop think him a fool? Did he imagine for one second that the count couldn't see what he was angling at? That he was insinuating that little Sophia was somehow involved? Not only could the count tell exactly what the bishop was driving at, he could have countered with a few insinuations of his own, and in iambic pentameter, no less. But the notion of Sophia's involvement was so unfounded, so preposterous, so outrageous, it did not deserve a response. Now, the count could not deny that Sophia had a certain playful streak, just as any child of 13 should, but she was no gadabout, no gadfly, nor no ne'er-do-well. In fact, as the count was returning from the manager's office, there she was sitting in the lobby, bent over some weighty textbook. It was a tableau familiar to any member of the Metropole staff. For hours on end, she sat in that very chair, memorizing capitals, conjugating verbs, and solving for X or Y. With an equal sense of dedication, she studied her sewing with Marina and her sauces with Emil. Why, ask anyone who knew Sophia to describe her, and they would tell you that she was studious, shy, and well-behaved, or, in a word, demure. As he mounted the stairs to the upper floors, the count enumerated the relevant facts like a jurist. In 8 years, Sophia had not thrown a single tantrum. Every day she had brushed her teeth and headed off to school without a fuss. And whether it was time to bundle up, buckle down, or eat her peas, she had done so without complaint. Even that little game of her own invention, which she had grown so fond of playing, was founded on the quality of poise that was beyond her years. Here is how it was played. The two of them would be sitting somewhere in the hotel, say reading in their study on a Sunday morning. At the stroke of 12, the count would set his book down and excuse himself to pay his weekly visit to the barber. After descending one flight in the belfry and traversing the hall to the main stair, he would continue his journey down 5 flights to the subfloor, where, having passed to the flower shop and newsstand, he would enter the barber shop only to discover Sophia reading quietly on the bench by the wall. Naturally, this resulted in the calling of the Lord's name in vain and the dropping of whatever happened to be in one's hand, 3 books and a glass of wine so far this year. Setting aside the fact that this game could prove fatal to a man approaching his 60s, one had to marvel at the young lady's expertise. She could seemingly transport herself from one end of the hotel to the other in the blink of an eye. Over the years, she must have mastered all of the hotel's hidden hallways, back passages, and connecting doors, while developing an uncanny sense of timing. But what was particularly impressive was her otherworldly repose upon discovery. for no matter how far or how fast she had traveled, there was not a hint of exertion about her, not a patter of the heart, not a panting of the breath, not a drop of perspiration on her brow, nor would she emit a giggle or exhibit the slightest smirk. On the contrary, with an expression that was studious, shy, and well-behaved, she would acknowledge a count with a friendly nod, and looking back at her book, turn the page demurely. The notion that a child so composed would conspire to the releasing of geese was simply preposterous. One might as well accuse her of toppling the Tower of Babel or knocking the nose off the Sphinx. True, she had been in the kitchen eating her supper when the chef de cuisine first received word that a certain Swiss diplomat who had ordered the roast geese had questioned the freshness of the poultry, and admittedly she was devoted to her Uncle Emil. Even so, how was a 13-year-old girl to spirit three adult fowl to the fourth floor of an international hotel at 7 in the morning without detection? The very idea, concluded the Count as he opened the door to his rooms, confounded one's reason, offended the laws of nature, and flew in the face of common Jesu Christi. Sophia, who the moment before had been in the lobby, was seated at the Grand Duke's desk, leaning diligently over her tome. "Oh, hello, Papa," she said without looking up. Apparently, it is no longer considered polite to look up from one's work when a gentleman enters a room. Sophia turned in her chair. "I'm sorry, Papa. I was immersed in my reading." "And what might that be?"
"It is an essay on cannibalism."
"An essay on cannibalism?"
"By Michel de Montaigne."
"Ah, yes. Well, that's time well spent, I'm sure," conceded the Count. But as he headed toward the study, he thought, "Michel de Montaigne." Then he shot a glance at the base of their bureau. "Is that Anna Karenina?" Sophia followed his gaze.
"Yes, I believe it is."
"But what is she doing down there?"
"She was the closest in thickness to Montaigne."
"The closest in thickness?
Is something wrong?"
"All I can say is that Anna Karenina would never have put you under a bureau just because you happen to be as thick as Montaigne." "The very idea is preposterous," the Count was saying. "How is a 13-year-old girl to spirit three fully grown geese up two flights of stairs without the slightest detection? Besides, I ask you, is such behavior even in her character?"
"Certainly not," said Emile.
"No, not in the least," agreed Andre.
The three men shook their heads in shared indignation. One of the advantages of working together for many years is that the daily rigmarole can be dispensed with quickly, leaving ample time for discussions of weightier concerns, such as rheumatism, the inadequacy of public transit, and the petty behavior of the inexplicably promoted. After 2 decades, the members of the Triumvirate knew a thing or two about the small-minded men who sat behind stacks of paper and the so-called gourmands from Geneva who couldn't tell a goose from a grouse. "It's outrageous," said the Count.
"Unquestionably."
"And to summon me for a half an hour before our daily meeting, at which there is never a shortage of important matters to discuss."
"Quite so," agreed Andrew. "Which reminds me, Alexander."
"Yes?"
"Before we open tonight, could you have someone sweep out the dumbwaiter?"
"Certainly. Is it a mess?"
"I'm afraid so. It has somehow become littered with feathers."
In saying this, Andrew used one of his legendary fingers to scratch his upper lip while Emile pretended to sip at his tea. And the Count? He opened his mouth with every intention of making the perfect rejoinder, the sort of remark that having cut one man to the quick would be quoted by others for years to come. But there was a knock at the door, and young Ilya entered with his wooden spoon. Over the course of the Great Patriotic War, Emil had lost the seasoned members of his crew one by one, even the whistling Stanislav. With every able-bodied man eventually in the army, he had been forced to staff his kitchen with adolescents. Thus, Ilya, who had been hired in 1943, had been promoted on the basis of seniority to sous-chef in 1945, at the ripe old age of 19. As a reflection of qualified confidence, Emile had bestowed upon him a spoon in place of a knife. "Well," said Emile, looking up with impatience. In response, Ilya hesitated. Emile looked to the other members of the Triumvirate and rolled his eyes as much to say, "You see what I must put up with." Then he turned back to his apprentice. A
As anyone can see, we are men with business to attend to. But apparently, you have something of such importance that you feel the need to interrupt. Well then, out with it, before we can expire from anticipation.
The young man opened his mouth, but then, rather than explain himself, he simply pointed his spoon toward the kitchen. Following the direction of the utensil, the members of the Triumvirate looked toward the office window, and there, near the door to the back stair, stood an unfortunate-looking soul in a ragged winter coat. At the sight of him, Emile grew crimson.
Who let him in here?
I did, sir. Emile stood so abruptly, he nearly knocked over his chair. Then, just as a commander will tear the epaulettes from the shoulders of an errant officer, Emile grabbed the spoon from Ilya's hand.
So you're the commissar of nincompoops now, is that, eh? When I had my back turned, you were promoted to the general secretary of bunglers?
The young man took a step back.
No, sir, I have not been promoted.
Emile smacked the table with the spoon, nearly cracking it in two.
Of course you haven't. How often have I told you not to let beggars in the kitchen? Don't you see that if you give him a crust of bread today, there will be 5 of his friends here tomorrow, and 50 the day after that?
Yes, sir,
But what?
He didn't ask for food.
Eh?
The young man pointed to the count. He asked for Alexander Ilyich. Andrew and Emil both looked at their colleague in surprise. The count, in turn, looked through the door at the beggar. Then, without saying a word, he rose from his chair, exited the office, and embraced this boon companion, whom he had not seen in 8 long years. Though Andrei and Emil had never met the stranger, as soon as they heard his name, they knew exactly who he was. The one who had lived with the count above the cobbler's shop. The one who had placed 1,000 miles in increments of 15 feet. The lover of Mayakovsky and Mandelstam, who, like so many others, had been tried and sentenced in the name of Article 58.
"Why don't you make yourself comfortable?" suggested Andrew with a gesture of his hand. "You can use Emile's office."
"Yes," agreed Emile. "By all means, my office."
With his impeccable instincts, Andrew led Mishka to the chair with its back to the kitchen, while Emile placed bread and salt on the table, that ancient Russian symbol of hospitality. A moment later, he returned with a plate of potatoes and cutlets of veal. Then the chef and Maître D' excused themselves, closing the door so that the two old friends could speak undisturbed. Mishka looked at the table. "Bread and salt," he said with a smile. As the count looked across at Mishka, he was moved by 2 contrary currents of emotion. On the one hand, there was that special joy of seeing a friend from youth unexpectedly, a welcome event no matter where or when. But at the same time, the count was confronted by the irrefutable facts of Mishka's appearance, 30 pounds lighter. Dressed in a threadbare coat and dragging one leg behind him, it was no wonder that Emil had mistaken him for a beggar. Naturally, the count had watched in recent years as age began to take its toll on the Triumvirate. He had noticed the occasional tremor in Andrew's left hand and the creeping deafness in Emil's right ear. He had noticed the graying of the former's hair and the thinning of the latter's. But with Mishka, here were not simply the ravages of time. Here were the marks of one man upon another, of an era upon its offspring. Perhaps the most striking was Mishka's smile. In their youth, Mishka had been almost earnest to a fault and never spoke with irony. Yet, when he said bread and salt, he wore the smile of the sarcast.
"It is so good to see you, Mishka," the count said after a moment. "I can't tell you how relieved I was when you sent word of your release. When did you return to Moscow?"
"I haven't," his friend replied with his new smile.
Upon the dutiful completion of his 8 years, Mishka explained he had been rewarded with a -6. To visit Moscow, he had borrowed a passport from a sympathetic soul with a passing likeness.
"Is that wise?"
the count asked with concern. Mishka shrugged.
"I arrived this morning from Yavas by train. I will be returning to Yavas later tonight."
"Yavas? Where is that?"
"Somewhere between where the wheat is grown and the bread is eaten."
"Are you teaching?"
the count asked tentatively.
"No," Mishka said with a shake of the head. "We are not encouraged to teach, but then we are not encouraged to read or write. We are hardly encouraged to eat."
So it was that Mishka began to describe his life in Yavas, and as he did so, he used the first person plural so often that the count assumed he must have moved there with a fellow inmate from the camps. But slowly, it became clear that in saying we, Mishka had no one person in mind. For Mishka, we encompassed all his fellow prisoners, and not simply those he had known in Arkhangelsk. It encompassed the million or more who had toiled on the Solovetsky Islands, or in the Savetslog, or on the White Sea Canal, whether they had toiled there in the 20s or the 30s, or toiled there still. Footnote. Stripped of their names and family ties, of their professions and possessions, herded together in hunger and hardship, the residents of the Gulag, the Zeks, became indistinguishable from one another. That, of course, was part of the point. Not content with the toll exacted by means of incarceration and forced labor in inhospitable climes, the supreme authorities sought to efface the enemies of the people. But an unanticipated consequence of this strategy was the creation of new polis. Having been stripped of their identities henceforth, the Zeks, though millions in numbers, would move in perfect unison, sharing in their privations as well as their will to persist. Henceforth, they would know each other whenever and wherever they met. They would make room for each other under their roofs and at their tables, addressing each other as brother and sister and friend, but never, never, ever, under any circumstance, as comrade. Back to the text, top of 289. Mishka was silent. "It is funny what comes to one at night," he said after a moment. After dropping our shovels and trudging to the barracks, we would swallow our gruel and pull our blankets to our chins, eager for sleep. But inevitably, some unexpected thought would come, some uninvited memory that wanted to be seized up, measured, and weighed. And many was the night I found myself thinking of that German you encountered in the bar, the one who claimed that vodka was Russia's only contribution to the West and who challenged anyone to name three more. I remember it well. I borrowed your observation that Tolstoy and Chekhov were the book ends of narrative, invoked Tchaikovsky, and then ordered the brute a serving of caviar. That's it. Mishka shook his head and then looked at the count with his smile. One night some years ago, I thought of another Sasha. A fifth contribution. Yes, a fifth contribution. The burning of Moscow. The count was taken aback. You mean in 1812? Mishka nodded. Can you imagine the expression on Napoleon's face when he was roused at 2 a.m. and stepped from his brand new bedroom in the Kremlin, only to find that the city he'd claimed just hours before had been set on fire by its citizens? Mishka gave a quiet laugh. Yes, the burning of Moscow was especially Russian, my friend. Of that there can be no doubt, because it was not a discrete event. It was the form of an event. One example plucked from a history of thousands. For as a people, we Russians have proved unusually adept at destroying that which we have created. Perhaps because of his limp, Mishka no longer got up to pace the room, but the count could see that he was pacing it with his eyes. Every country has its grand canvas, Sasha, the so-called masterpiece that hangs in a hallowed hall and sums up the national identity for generations to come. For the French, it is Delacroix's Liberty Leading the People. For the Dutch, Rembrandt's Night Watch. For the American, Washington Crossing the Delaware. And for we Russians, it is a pair of twins. Nikolai Gay's Peter the Great Interrogating Alexei, and Ilya Repin's Ivan the Terrible and His Son. For decades, these two paintings have been revered by our public, praised by our critics, and sketched by our diligent students of the arts. And yet, what do they depict? In one, our most enlightened Tsar studies his oldest son with suspicion, on the verge of condemning him to death, while in the other, unflinching, Ivan cradles the body of his eldest, having already exacted the supreme measure with a swing of the scepter to the head. Our churches, known the world over for their idiosyncratic beauty, for their brightly colored spires and improbable cupolas, we raise one by one. We topple the statues of old heroes and strip their names from the streets as if they had been figments of our imagination. Our poets we either silence or wait patiently for them to silence themselves. Mishka picked up his fork, struck it in the untouched veal, and raised it in the air. Do you know that back in 30, when they announced the mandatory collectivization of farming, half our peasants slaughtered their own livestock rather than give them up to the cooperatives? 14 million head of cattle left to the buzzards and flies. He gently returned the cut of meat to its plate, as if in show of respect. How can we understand this, Sasha? What is it about a nation that would foster a willingness in its people to destroy their own artworks, ravage their own cities, and kill their own progeny without compunction? To foreigners, it must seem shocking. It must seem as if we Russians have such a brutish indifference that nothing, not even the fruit of our loins, is viewed as sacrosanct. And how that notion pained me, how it unsettled me. Exhausted as I was, the very thought of it could keep me tossing until dawn. Then one night, he came to me in a dream, Sasha. Mayakovsky himself. He quoted some lines of verse, beautiful, haunting lines that I had never heard before, about the bark of a birch tree glinting in the winter sun. Then he loaded his revolver with an exclamation point and put the barrel to his chest. When I awoke, I suddenly understood that this propensity for self-destruction was not an abomination, not something to be ashamed of or abhorred. It was our greatest strength. We turn the gun on ourselves not because we are more indifferent and less cultured than the British or the French or the Italians. On the contrary, we are prepared to destroy that which we have created because we believe more than any of them in the power of the picture, the poem, the prayer, or the person. Mishka shook his head. Mark my words, my friend. We have not burned Moscow to the ground for the last time. As in the past, Mishka talked with a fervored intensity, almost as if he were making points to himself. But once he had spoken his piece, he looked across the table and saw the distressed expression on the Count's face. Then he suddenly laughed in a heartfelt manner, without bitterness or irony, and reached across the table to squeeze his old friend's forearm. I see that I have unsettled you, Sasha, with my talk of revolvers. But don't worry, I am not through yet. I still have something to attend to. In fact, that is why I slipped into the city, to visit the library for a little project that I am working on. With a sense of relief, the Count recognized the old spark in Mishka's eye, the one that inevitably flashed before he threw himself headlong into a scrape. "Is it a work of poetry?" asked the Count. "Poetry? Yes, in a manner of speaking, I suppose it is. But it is also something more fundamental, something that can be built upon. I'm not ready to share it just yet, but when I am, you shall be the first." By the time they came out of the office and the Count led Mishka to the back stair, the kitchen was in full swing. On the counter were onions being minced, beets being sliced, hens being plucked. From the stove where the pots simmered, Emil signaled to the Count that he should wait a moment. After wiping his hands on his apron, he came to the door with some food wrapped in brown paper. "A little something for your journey, Mikhail Fedorovich." Mikhail looked taken aback by the offering, and for a moment the Count thought his friend was going to refuse it on principle, but Mishka thanked the chef and took the parcel in hand. Andrew was there too now, to express his pleasure at finally meeting Mishka and to wish him well. Having returned the sentiments, Mishka opened the door to the stairwell, but then paused. Having taken a moment to look over the kitchen with all of its activity and abundance, to look from gentle Andrei to heartfelt Emil, he turned to the Count. "Who would have imagined," he said, "when you were sentenced to life in the metropole all those years ago, that you had just become the luckiest man in all of Russia?" Middle of page 292 with the star. We'll get ourselves to the next star and then we'll stop. At 7:30 that evening, when the Count entered the yellow room, Osip tamped out his cigarette and leapt from his chair. "Ah, here you are, Alexander. I thought a quick trip to San Francisco was in order. We haven't been back in a year. Get the lights, will you? As Osip hurried to the back of the room, the Count absently took his seat at the table for two and put his napkin in his lap.
Alexander.
The Count looked up.
Yes?
The lights. Oh, my apologies. The Count rose, switched off the lights, and lingered by the wall.
Are you going to take your seat again? Asked Osip.
Ah, yes, of course. The Count returned to the table and sat in Osip's chair.
Is everything all right, my friend? You do not seem yourself.
No, no, assured the Count with a smile. Everything is excellent. Please proceed. Osip waited for a moment to be sure. Then he threw the switch and hurried back to the table as the grand old shadows began to flicker on the dining room wall. 2 months after what Osip liked to refer to as the de Tocqueville affair, he had appeared in the yellow room with a projector and an uncensored print of A Day at the Races. From that night onward, the two men left the tomes of history on the bookshelf where they belonged and advanced their studies of America through the medium of film. Osip Ivanovich had actually mastered the English language right down to the past perfect progressive as early as 1939. But American movies still deserved their careful consideration, he argued, not simply as windows into Western culture, but as unprecedented mechanisms of class repression. For with cinema, the Yanks had apparently discovered how to placate the entire working class at the cost of a nickel a week. Just look at their depression, he said. From beginning to end, it lasted 10 years, an entire decade in which the proletariat was left to fend for itself, scrounging in alleys and begging at chapel doors. If ever there had been a time for the American worker to cast off the yoke, surely that was it. But did they join their brothers in arms? Did they shoulder their axes and splinter the doors of the mansions? Not even for an afternoon. Instead, they shuffled to the nearest movie house, where the latest fantasy was dangled before them like a pocket watch at the end of a chain. Yes, Alexander, it behooves us to study this phenomenon with the utmost diligence and care. So, study it they did. And the Count could confirm that Osip approached the task with the utmost diligence and care, for when a movie was played, he could hardly sit still. During the Westerns, when a fight broke out in a saloon, he would clench his fists, fend off a blow, give a left to the gut, and an uppercut to the jaw. When Fyodor Astaire danced with Ginger Rogers, his fingers would open wide and flutter about his waist while his feet shuffled back and forth on the carpet. And when Bela Lugosi emerged from the shadows, Osip leapt up from his chair and nearly fell to the floor. Then, as the credits rolled, he would shake his head with an expression of moral disappointment. Shameful, he would say. Scandalous. Insidious. Or insidious, excuse me. Like the seasoned scientist, Osip would coolly dissect whatever they had just observed. The musicals were pastries designed to placate the impoverished with daydreams of unattainable bliss. The horror movies were sleights of hand in which the fears of the working man have been displaced by those of pretty girls. The vaudevillian comedies were preposterous narcotics. And the westerns? They were the most devious propaganda of all, fables in which evil is represented by collectives who rustle and rob, while virtue is a lone individual who risks his life to defend the sanctity of someone else's private property. In sum, Hollywood is the single most dangerous force in the history of class struggle. Or so Osip argued, until he discovered the genre of American movies that would come to be known as film noir. With rapt attention, he watched the likes of this Gun for Hire, Shadow of a Doubt, and Double Indemnity. What is this? He would ask of no one in particular. Who is making these movies? Under what auspices? From one to the next, they seemed to depict an America in which corruption and cruelty lounged on the couch, in which justice was a beggar and kindness a fool, in which loyalties were fashioned from paper and self-interest was fashioned from steel. In other words, they provided an unflinching portrayal of capitalism as it actually was. How did this happen, Alexander? Why did they allow these movies to be made? Do they not realize they're hammering a wedge beneath their own foundation stones? But no singular star of the genre captivated Osip more than Humphrey Bogart. With the exception of Casablanca, which Osip viewed as a woman's movie, they had watched all of Bogart's films at least twice, whether in The Petrified Forest, To Have or Have Not, or especially The Maltese Falcon. Ossip appreciated the actor's hardened looks, his sardonic remarks, his general lack of sentiment. You notice how in the first act he always seems so removed and indifferent, but once his indignation is roused, Alexander, there was no one more willing to do what is necessary, to act clear-eyed, quick, and without compunction. Here truly is a man of intent. In the yellow room, Ossip took two mouthfuls of Emile's braised veal with a caviar sauce, a gulp of Georgian wine, and looked up just in time to see the image of the Golden Gate Bridge. In the minutes that followed, once again, the services of Sam Spade were enlisted by the alluring, if somewhat mysterious, Miss Wonderly. Once again, Spade's partner was gunned down in an alley just hours before Floyd Thursby met a similar fate. And once again, Joel Cairo, the fat man, and Brigid O'Shaughnessy, having surreptitiously joined forces, drugged Spade's whiskey, and headed for the wharf, their elusive quest finally within reach. But even as Spade was nursing his head, a stranger in a black coat and hat stumbled into his office, dropped a bundle to the floor, and collapsed dead on the couch. "Do you think Russians are particularly brutish, Ossip?" asked the Count. "What's that?" whispered Otis. Ossip whispered, as if there were others in the audience whom he didn't want to disturb. "Do you think we are essentially more brutish than the French or the English or these Americans?"
"Alexander," Ossip hissed, as Spade was washing the stranger's blood from his hands. "What on earth are you talking about?"
"I mean, do you think we are more apt to others to destroy that which we have created?" Ossip, who had not yet torn his eyes from the screen, now turned to stare at the Count in disbelief. Then he abruptly rose, stomped to the projector, and froze the film at the very moment that Spade, having placed the roughly wrapped bundle on his neck, was taking his penknife from his pocket.
Is it possible that you don't see what's happening?" he demanded while pointing at the screen. Having traveled from the Orient to the docks of San Francisco, Captain Jacoby has been shot 5 times. He has jumped from a burning ship, stumbled through the city, and used his final breaths to bring Comrade Spadsky this mysterious package wrapped in paper and bound in string. And you chose this moment to engage in metaphysics?
The Count, who had turned around, was holding up a hand to cut the glare from the projection.
"But, Ossip," he said, "we have watched him open the bundle on at least 3 different occasions.
3 occasions?
What difference does it make? You have read Anna Karenina at least 10 times, but I'd wager you still cry when she throws herself under the train."
"That's something else altogether."
"Is it?"
There was silence. Then, with an expression of exasperation, Ossip turned off the projector. He flicked off the lights and returned to the table.
"All right, my friend. I can see that you are vexed by something. Let's see if we can make sense of it so we can get on with our studies."
Thus, the Count described for Ossip the conversation he'd had with Mishka, or rather, he relayed Mishka's views on the burning of Moscow, and the toppling of statues, and the silencing of poets, and the slaughter of 14 million head of cattle. Ossip, having already aired his frustrations, now listened to the Count attentively, occasionally nodding his head at Mishka's various points.
"All right," he said, once the Count had finished. "So what is it exactly that is bothering you, Alexander? Does your friend's assertion shock you? Does it offend your sensibilities? I understand that you are worried about his state of mind, but isn't it possible that he is right in his opinions while being wrong in his sentiments?"
"What do you mean?"
"It is like the Maltese Falcon."
"Ossip, please."
"No, I am quite serious. What is the black bird if not a symbol of Western heritage itself? A sculpture fashioned by knights of the Crusade from gold and jewels as tribute to a king. It is an emblem of the church and the monarchies, those rapacious institutions that have served as the foundation for all of Europe's art and ideas. Well, who is to say that their love of that heritage isn't as misguided as the fat man's for his falcon? Perhaps that is exactly what must be swept aside before their people can hope to progress.
His tone grew softer.
"The Bolsheviks are not Visigoths, Alexander. We are not the barbarian hordes descending upon Rome and destroying all that is fine out of ignorance and envy. It is the opposite. In 1916, Russia was a barbarian state. It was the most illiterate nation in Europe.
with the majority of its population living in modified serfdom, tilling the fields with wooden plows, beating their wives with candlelight, or by candlelight, collapsing on their benches drunk with vodka, and then waking at dawn to humble themselves before their icons. That is, living exactly as their forefathers had lived 500 years ago. Years before. Is it not possible that our reverence for all the statues and cathedrals and ancient institutions was precisely what was holding us back? Ossip paused, taking a moment to refill their glasses with wine. But where do we stand now? How far have we come? By marrying American tempo with Soviet aims, we are on the verge of universal literacy. Russia's long-suffering women, our second serfdom, have been elevated to the status of equals. We have built whole new cities, and our industrial production outpaces that of most of Europe. But at what cost? Ossip slapped the table. At the greatest cost. What do you think the achievements of the Americans, envied the world over, came without a cost? Just ask their African brothers. And do you think that the engineers who designed their illustrious skyscrapers or built their highways hesitated for one moment to level the lovely little neighborhoods that stood in the way? I guarantee you, Alexander, they laid the dynamite and pushed the plungers themselves. As I've said to you before, we and the Americans will lead the rest of this century because we are the only nations who have learned to brush the past aside instead of bowing before it. But where they have done so in service of their beloved individualism, we are attempting to do so in service of the common good. And we'll stop there and catch up in the middle of this chapter again, middle of this chapter, next time. All right, hope you're enjoying. See you next time.